was still absorbed in his notebook, and I flitted out the door and round the corner of the tower in a wink. Even though it is considered unlucky to do so, I worked my way counterclockwise, Widdershins, as Daffy calls it, round the church, pausing before I attempted the north side. But the coast was clear. Cynthia Richardson was gone. Gladys was basking happily in the sun, and I wheeled her slowly through the churchyard, dodging from tombstone to tombstone, westward and south, along the winding riverbank. My normally drab cardigan and skirt, further camouflaged with splotches and smears of grave mud, should make me nearly invisible among the weathered monuments. When we reached a stone wall that marked the boundary, I lifted Gladys over and set her down gently on the other side, and moments later we were spinning happily home along the road to Buckshaw. I had not noticed until now, as I cycled along the avenue of chestnut trees, how seedy and run down our home had begun to look. Its grass uncut, its hedges untrimmed, its gravel unraked, and its windows unwashed. The place had a look of neglect that snagged at my heart. Not that it was Father's fault. His lack of ready funds had caused him to narrow his personal world until there was little left to him but his own small study, a little haven. Or was it a prison, in which he could insulate himself from a demanding world behind a barricade of ancient and changeless postage stamps? Nor could Dogger be blamed. He did as much as he was physically and mentally able. Sometimes, when he was up to being gardener, the house and its grounds looked as spruce as they did in those long-gone days when they had been photographed for Country Life. At other times, functioning simply as Father's man was more than enough of a strain on his shattered nerves, and I, for one, gave thanks that Dogger was able even to manage Father's boots. His camp stool was nowhere in sight. Dogger had vanished to wherever it is that he vanishes. As before, it was a matter of getting across the foyer and upstairs without being seen. If Daffy or Feely saw the state of my clothing, it would be a matter of seconds before Father had been tattled to, and if Father himself were the first to catch a glimpse of my filthy condition, well, I shuddered at the very thought of the tongue-lashing. Thankfully, my Macintosh, having been washed by yesterday's rain, was spotless. I turned up the collar and buttoned it from top to bottom. Who knows, I might even be praised for dressing warmly and keeping dry. My feet were the only problem. Not only were they bare, shoeless and sockless, they were also caked with the reeking remains of Cassandra Cottlestone. I bent at the knees until the hem of my coat was touching the floor tiles, then waddled awkwardly across the foyer like a penguin, or perhaps like Mr. Pastry making his exit at the end of his pantomime, the passing out ceremony. I must have looked as if I'd been sawn off at the knees, or driven into the ground like a tent peg. I was halfway up the stairs when I heard footsteps in the upstairs hall. Curses, I thought. Legs appeared between the upper banisters, legs wearing black trousers. A moment later, the rest of Dogger appeared. I shall be up directly with the hot water, he said quietly from the corner of his mouth as he passed me on the stairs. The man was uncanny. I was soaking in my tin hip bath, trying not to think too hard about the various bits that were floating to the surface of the steaming stew. The hot water, in addition to my fatigue, must have caused me to nod off. One instant, I was wrinkling like a dumpling, and the next, I was again at St. Tancred's, sitting on the organ bench. I watched with fascination as long white fingers stroked the keys, illuminated only by a pair of candles, one at each end of the music rack. The rest of the church was in darkness. Black notes flying across a white page, black shadows of the hands flying like spiders across white ivory. I recognized the music as Chopin's Funeral March. Feely had played it just 2 weeks ago as old Mrs. Fuller was led down the aisle for the last time. Dum, dum, da, dum, dum, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum. It had such an air of finality about it. Once you're sent to the grave, there's no going back. Unless you're dug up again, of course.
Feely, I said with a shudder, do you think...
I turned to look at my sister, but it was not Feely beside me on the organ bench. The black, piggish snout turned slowly toward me in the darkness, its glassy eyes brimming with blood. Even before it spoke, I could smell its filthy rubber skin, the graveyard reek of its hot, rotting breath.
Harriet,
the thing croaked.
Harriet.
I awoke screaming, my hands flailing the water and my feet thrashing. I leapt out of the tub, sending a tidal wave splashing onto the floor. My teeth were chattering. My skin, in spite of the now tepid water, was icy cold. I lurched across the room, struggled into my bathrobe, and collapsed into a huddle on the bed. It was all I could manage. My breath was still coming in ragged gasps, my heart pounding like a madman beating away on a drum. There was a light knock at the door, but I could not find within myself whatever it took to answer. After a few moments, it opened slowly, and Dogger's face appeared.
Are you all right?
He asked, sizing me up as he came across the room toward me. I overcame the iron muscles in my neck just enough to nod stiffly. Dogger touched my forehead with the inside of his wrist, then placed a thumb under the angle of my jaw.
You've had a fright, he said.
It was a dream.
Ah, he said,
wrapping a quilt round my shoulders.
Dreams will sometimes do that.
Lie down, please. As I stretched out on the bed, Dogger placed a pillow beneath my feet.
Dreams, he said. Very beneficial things, dreams. Most useful.
I must have looked at him with begging in my eyes.
Fright can be remarkably healing, he said. It has been known even to cure gout and to alleviate fever.
Gout? I murmured.
A painful disease of elderly gentlemen who love their wine more than their livers.
I think I smiled, but my eyelids were suddenly made of lead. Iron neck, leaden eyes, I thought. I'm growing stronger. And then I slept. Chapter 8. When I opened my eyes, there was daylight at my windows, although the sun had not yet risen. The hands of my brass alarm clock pointed sleepily to 5:30. Rats! I had slept straight through my intended midnight visit to the crypt. Now I should have to wait another 24 hours, by which time the police would probably...
Good morning, Miss Flavia,
said a voice at my elbow, and I nearly jumped out of my skin. Oh! Dogger, I didn't know you were here. You startled me.
I'm sorry. I didn't intend to. I trust you slept well.
By the slow, stiff way in which he was unfolding himself from the chair at my bedside, I knew that he had been sitting there all through the night. Very well, thank you, Dogger. I think I rather overdid things yesterday.
Indeed, he agreed. But I believe you are much improved this morning.
Thank you, yes.
In 10 minutes, I shall be breakfasting on tea and toast in the kitchen, if you care to join me,
Dogger said. Bags eye the crust, I said, fully aware of what a tremendous honour it was to be asked. When Dogger had gone, I washed my face and neatly rebraided my pigtails, going so far even to tie each one with a bit of fresh white, for Easter, ribbon. After Dogger's sleepless night, the least I could do, I thought, was to look decent at the breakfast table.
We were seated in the kitchen, Dogger and I. The rest of the household was not yet awake, and Mrs. Mullet wouldn't arrive from the village for another hour. There had fallen between us what Dogger once referred to as a companionable silence, a little parcel of time during which neither of us felt any particular need to talk. The only sound in the kitchen was the scratching of our knives on toast and the slight ticking of the silver toaster as the little red snakes of its innards turned white bread to brown. It was quite wonderful when you came to think of it, the way in which the red-hot electric element's dry heat caused the bread's sugars to interact with its amino acids, producing a whole new set of flavors. The Maillard reaction, it was called, after Louis-Camille Maillard, the French chemist who had made a study of toasting and suntanning. As my teeth crunched into the tasty crust, I realized suddenly that toast eaten hot and fresh from the toaster is vastly superior in taste to toast brought to a distant table. Although there seemed to be a lesson here, I couldn't for the moment think what it might be. I was the first to break the silence. "Have you ever heard of a person named Adam Sowerby?" I asked.
"An acquaintance of your father's, I believe," Dogger said. "Rather a well-known botanist nowadays. They were at school together."
"A friend of father's? Why hadn't Adam told me so? Why had father never mentioned his name?"
"His work often takes him to old churches," Dogger continued, not looking at me.
"I know," I said. "He's hoping to find old seeds in St. Tancred's tomb. He gave me a lift into the village yesterday."
"Yes," Dogger said, helping himself to another piece of toast and spreading the honey with surgical precision. "I watched you from an upstairs window."
No one looked up as I entered the dining room. Father, Feely, and Daffy were sitting as they always sat, each in their own invisible compartment. The only difference this morning was Feely's appearance. Her face was chalky white, with purplish rims round her red eyelids. She had, without a doubt, spent the night grieving for the late Mr. Qualicut. I could almost smell the candles. Evidently, she had not yet shared the news of his demise with Father. For some complicated reason, she was keeping it to herself, almost as if she were treasuring it. A shiver of cold air told me I had just brushed shoulders with a ghost. I slipped into my chair and lifted the lid of the patent food warmer. This morning's main dish consisted of Mrs. Mullet's omelettes royale, those flat rubber pancakes of pale egg embedded with particles of red and green peppers and chunks of chutney, which, when Father was not present, we called toad on the road. I speared one of these squid-like monstrosities with my fork and passed it on a plate to Feely. She covered her mouth with the palm of her hand, made a slight but still detectable retching noise, pushed back her chair, and hurried from the room. I raised a quizzical eyebrow at Father as he looked up from the London philatelist, but he was not to be distracted from his hobby. For a moment, he listened to Feely's retreating footsteps, as if hearing the baying of a distant hound, then went back to reading his journal. "I met a friend of yours yesterday, Father," I said. "His name is Adam Sowerby." Father came slowly up again out of the depths.
"Sowerby," he said at last. "Wherever did you meet him?"
"Here," I said, "at Buckshaw, in the forecourt. He has the most remarkable old roller, full of plants."
Father said,
and returned to reading about engravings of Queen Victoria's head. "He gave me a lift into the village," I went on. "He's here to look for ancient seeds when they open St. Tancred's tomb." Again Father surfaced. It was like carrying on a conversation with a deep-sea diver who resubmerged after every sentence.
"Sowerby, you say?"
"Yes, Adam Sowerby. Dogger says he's an old friend of yours." Father closed his journal, removed his reading spectacles, and tucked them into his waistcoat pocket. An old friend? Yes, I dare say he is.
Speaking of St. Tancred's tomb, by the way, I said casually, now that I had Father's undivided attention, Mr. Cullycut was found dead in it yesterday. Daffy's head snapped up from her book. She had been listening all along.
Collie, she said. Collie dead? Does Feely know?
I nodded. I did not say that she had known since yesterday at breakfast.
He appeared to have been murdered.
Appeared? Father asked instantly. I had to give him full marks for lightning quick perception. Appeared? Do you mean you were there? That you saw him? Dead?
I discovered the body, I said modestly. Daffy's jaw fell open like a hangman's trap.
Really, Flavia, Father said, this is simply too much.
He fished out his spectacles, put them on, removed them, and put them on again. In the past, he had seemed rather proud of the corpses I had happened upon. But even corpses, I suppose, have their limit.
Cullycut, you say? The organist chap. What's he doing dead?
It was a silly question, but also an excellent one. Mrs. Mallet, who had come in from the kitchen as Father spoke, sniffed.
They say as how he had it coming, that one. All them carryings on in the churchyard. Turned into a sow by devils he was, like them gabardine swine in the Bible.
Carryings on in the churchyard? Whatever could she mean by that? When I talked to him in the tower, Mr. Haskins had mentioned mysterious lights seen floating in the churchyard by the ARP and the fire watchers. But that had been years ago, during the war. Could these strange ceremonies, or whatever they were, still be taking place? One thing of which I was almost certain, which connected that remote past with the present, was this. Since there was now only one mask left in the trunk, the gas mask strapped to poor dead Mr. Cullycut's face must have come from that same wooden chest in the tower. There would surely have been more than one, originally. In fact, I would be willing to bet my Bunsen burner that the two were identical. Not that I was an expert on gas masks. There was Daffy's, of course, a gaily coloured Mickey Mouse mask of red India rubber with a blue tin nozzle that had been issued to her when she was no more than 3 years old, and which she still kept hanging close at hand from its straps at the side of her looking glass.
You never know, she once told me, with rather an odd look on her face.
Then, too, there was that mask of early vintage which was kept in my laboratory in case of certain chemical accidents. It had been given personally to Uncle Tar not long before his death in 1928 by Winston Churchill, who was, at the time, Chancellor of the Exchequer. I had gleaned the details of their meeting from one of Uncle Tar's extensive diaries, a volume of which I always kept at hand on my night table for gripping bedtime reading. Churchill had paid an autumnal visit to Uncle Tar at Buckshaw, and as they strolled together beside the ornamental lake, Churchill had offered a cigar, which, since his particular weakness was Pym's number 2 cup, Uncle Tar had politely refused, and said,
There is war in the wind, Tarquin. I can smell it. England can ill afford to lose a Deluce.
I could almost hear the voice of that bulldog man uttering the words, which certainly had a Churchillian ring to them.
Thank you, Mrs. Mallet, Father was saying
as my thoughts came back to the present. He was thanking her not for her tales of dire doings in the churchyard, but for the toad on the road whose remains she was now removing from the table. Daffy, marking her place in The Monk with one of the crepe paper serviettes we had been forced to adopt since hard times, her words, had fallen upon us, slipped silently from the room. Father was not far behind her.
Tell me about the sows in the churchyard, Mrs. Mallet, I said, now that we were alone. I've become quite keen on Bible studies recently. In fact, I've been thinking of starting a scrapbook of New Testament animals and their...
That isn't safe for ears, the likes of yours,
she replied rather snappishly, I thought.
Alf says Mr. Ridley Smith, the magistrate, tipped him off that 'tisn't safe to be hanging about that church till an elephant of justice has been served, which makes good sense to me.
Oh, piffle, I said, changing tactics. It's no more than village gossip. Father's always warning us about village gossip, and I think he's quite right.
I could hardly believe my mouth was saying this.
Oh, village gossip, is it? Mrs. Mallet snorted, putting down the stack of dishes she had been carrying and planting her hands on her hips.
Then tell me, if you please, miss, why they had to call Dr. Darby to give Mrs. Richardson a shot after what she seen in the churchyard.
I let my mouth loll open. If I could have drooled at will, I would have.
Tell me, I begged, please, what was it?
Mrs. Mallet bit her lip, fighting like mad the urge to be discreet.
A ghost, a coming up out of a grave, that's what, she said in a low, harsh voice, her eyes wide as saucers, nervously scanning the four corners of the room.
In daylight, she added, in broad daylight.
Mind you, I've said nothing.
Although I was still a little shaky from my nightmare, I was soon pedalling back toward the church, as if drawn by a magnet. The fresh air would do me good, I thought, a bit more oxygen to spike the old sea water. Even as I approached the churchyard, I could see that my way was barred. Although the blue Vauxhall was parked in a different spot from where it had been yesterday, it was still uncomfortably close to the front door. It was not Sergeant Woolmer who sat in it this time, but Sergeant Graves, my sister's failed suitor. I skidded to a stop, dismounted from Gladys, and ducked down behind the stone wall. How could I get past the man? It is remarkable how the human mind works. I was thinking of the church, which reminded me of hymns, when what popped into my head, as if by magic, were these words. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. Hymn 373. Of course! Right there, growing wild along the wall, were the first flowers of spring. Crocuses, snowdrops, primroses, even a huddle of daffodils, which had likely been turfed out after some funeral or another, and had taken wild refuge in the shelter of the stones. I picked a sampling of these and gathered them into a quite decent bouquet, whose blues, yellows, and whites were dazzling in the morning sun. As a final touch, I removed one of my white hair ribbons and gave it several turns round the stems, tying it into an elaborate and actually quite pretty bow. Then I walked up the path to the church door as bold as you please.
"Flowers for the altar," I said, waving the bouquet under the sergeant's nose as I swept past him.
What man would dare stand in my way? I had almost reached the door when Sergeant Graves spoke.
"Hold on," he said.
I stopped, turned, and raised an eyebrow.
"Yes, Sergeant?"
He suddenly went all casual, shrugging and examining his fingernails as if what he were about to say didn't matter, as if it were nothing, no more than an afterthought.
"Is it true what they say about your sister? I've heard she's getting married."
"Why, whoever told you that?"
I was fishing. "The police hear things," he said sadly, and as he spoke the words, I noticed that for the first time since I had met him, Sergeant Graves was not wearing his perpetual boyish smile.
"It might be only a rumor," I said,
unwilling to be the one to break the sergeant's heart. For a moment, we stood staring into each other's eyes. Just a couple of human beings. And then I turned away and stepped into the church. To keep from hugging him. The interior was a cool, dim, tinted twilight, and was filled with that vague and unnerving vibration that churches have when they are empty. As if the souls of those in the crypts below are singing. Or perhaps cursing, at a pitch too high or too low for for the rest of us to hear. But what I was detecting now was no choir of souls. A choir of hornets was more like it. A rising and falling. What was that word that Daffy loved to use?
Ululation.
Yes, that was it.
Ululation. A faint howling, like the wail of distant air raid sirens, snatched away now and then by the wind.
I stood motionless beside a stone pillar. The sound continued, echoing back from the vaulted roof. I could see no one. I took a cautious step or two, and then a few more. Was it coming from the organ casing in the chancel? Had a pipe become stuck? Or could it be the wind howling through a hole? I remembered suddenly that I had come back to the church yesterday, before being distracted by the corpse of Mr. Callicutt, to look for a broken window through which a bat might have entered. I tiptoed up the carpeted steps and into the chancel. The humming was louder here. How odd! It almost seemed as if... Yes, it was a tune. I recognized the melody. Saviour, when in dust to thee. Feely had been singing it as she practiced on the piano just a few days ago.
Saviour, when in dust to thee, lo, we bow the adoring knee.
I had lingered in the hall to listen to the rather gruesome words.
By the anguish sigh that told, treachery lurked within thy fold.
Feely sang it with such feeling. I remember thinking, they just don't write hymns like that anymore. The haunting words were running through my head now as I crept stealthily along the nave, all of my senses on alert for the source of the weird whining. A floorboard creaked. I turned my head slowly, the hair at the back of my neck standing on end. There was nobody there. The humming stopped abruptly.
Girl!
It came from behind me. I spun round on my heel. She was sitting in an oak clergy chair at the end of the choir stalls, whose elaborately carved wings had kept her hidden until I had come directly alongside. Hugely magnified eyes stared out at me through thick lenses, which were also reflecting, in a most unsettling way, the dripping stained glass colours of John the Baptist's severed head. It was Miss Tanti.
Girl!
Except for a starched white doily for a collar, she was dressed all in black bombazine, as if her clothing had been stitched together from the cloth under which the photographer hides his head before squeezing the rubber bulb.
Girl, what are you up to?
Oh, good morning, Miss Tanti. I'm sorry, I didn't see you there.
My words were greeted with rather a rude grunting noise.
You were skulking, and don't pretend you weren't.
In ordinary circumstances, someone who spoke to me like this never saw another sunrise. In my mind, at least, I dealt out poisons with a happy hand. But in this case, because I needed information, I decided to make an exception.
I wasn't skulking, Miss Tanti. I brought some flowers to put on the altar.
I shoved them almost into her face, and the huge goggles moved from side to side, examining the blooms and stems as if they were coloured serpents.
"Hm," she said. "Wildflowers. Wildflowers have no place on the altar. A girl of your breeding ought to know that."
So, she knew who I was.
"But,"
I said.
"But me, no buts," she said, holding up a hand. "I am chairman of the Altar Guild, and as such, it is my business to know what's what. Give them here, and I shall throw them on the rubbish heap on my way out."
"I heard you humming," I said, putting the flowers behind my back.
It sounded lovely, what with all the echoes and so forth.
Actually, it hadn't sounded lovely. Eerie was more the word. But rule 9B was this: change the subject.
"Saviour, when in dust to thee," I said, one of my favourite hymns. I recognised it even without the words. You have such a wonderful voice, Miss Tanti. They must always be simply pleading with you to make phonograph recordings.
You could feel the thaw. In an instant, the temperature in the church went up by at least 10 degrees Celsius,
or 283 degrees Kelvin. She patted her hair. And then, without a word of warning, she drew in a deep breath and, with her hands clasped at her waist, began to sing.
Saviour, when in dust to thee, low we bow the adoring knee.
There was no doubt she had a remarkable voice. A voice that, because of the way in which, at least at close range, it rattled your bones, might even have been called thrilling. It seemed to originate from somewhere deep in her body, from down among her kidneys, I guessed.
By thy deep expiring groan, by the sad sepulchral stone, by the vault whose dark abode.
Her voice swept over me in waves, enveloping me in a kind of warm dankness. She sang all five verses. And what feeling Miss Tanti put into the words. It was almost as if she were taking you on a guided tour of her own life. When she had finished, she sat transfixed, as if dazed by her own powers.
That was super, Miss Tanti, I said.
And it was.
I don't think she heard me. She was staring up into the coloured light at Herodias and Salome, those two triumphant women etched in acid into glass.
Miss Tanti?
Oh, she said with a start. I was somewhere else.
That was magnificent, I said,
having had time to choose a more refined word. Her great bulging eyes swiveled round and focused on me like a pair of spotlights.
Now then, she said, the truth. I want the truth. What are you up to?
Nothing, Miss Tanti. I just brought these flowers.
I produced them from behind my back. To place on the altar.
Yes?
In memory of poor Mr. Corlicut.
A hiss came out of her.
Give them here,
she rasped, and before I could protest, she stood and snatched the posies from my hand.
Don't waste your crocuses, she said.
Chapter 9.
Boom!
A cannon shot from the back of the church. Miss Tanti and I blinked at each other in surprise, then swiveled our heads toward the source of the noise. The great church door, a massive thing of oak and studded iron straps, had slammed shut. There was a scurrying in the shadows.
Who's that?
Miss Tanti called out in a commanding voice. There was no answer. A kind of feverish mumbling came from somewhere back among the shadowy pews.
Who's there? Make yourself known at once.
The vials of wrath. The blood of a dead man.
The words came to our ears in a weird whisper, made louder by the towering glass and the surrounding stone.
Come into the light,
Miss Tanti commanded, as a bundle of animated rags worked its way jerkily along the kneeling benches.
For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and now hast given us blood to drink.
It's Meg, I said, from Gibbet Wood. Mad Meg, I hesitated to use her nickname in front of Miss Tanti, lived in a hovel in the wood on Gibbet Hill, not far from the rotting remains of the 18th century gibbet that had been given both hill and wood their names.
Mad Meg,
you mean, Miss Tanti said loudly.
Meg, come out here at once, into the light, where we can have a look at you.
The blood of saints, given for Meg to drink,
Meg said with a horrible wet snicker.
Rubbish, Miss Tanti said. You're talking nonsense.
Meg had now reached a spot of light
that fell at the end of a row of pews. Dressed in a rusty black garment, which might have been one of Miss Tanti's cast-offs, she began moving toward us, her head nodding, the red glass cherry on her flower-pot hat bobbing with saucy detachment. She pointed with a filthy crooked finger to the timbers of the hammer-beam roof that arched above our heads.
"The blood of saints and prophets," she repeated, again nodding her head at us as if to confirm her words, looking eagerly from Miss Tanti's face to mine for some sign of understanding.
"The Book of Revelation," Miss Tanti said, "chapter 16.
Meg looked at her blankly.
"Saints and prophets," she said in reply, her voice now a hoarse but confidential whisper. "Blood."
Her pale, staring eyes were almost as bulbous as Miss Tanti's. At the back of the church, a long finger of dazzling daylight fell suddenly into the porch as the door swung open and two dark figures appeared. One of them I recognized at once as the vicar. The other, of course, it was Adam Sowerby. I had almost forgotten about the man. They came strolling casually up the center aisle together as if they were out for a pleasant walk in a country lane.
"Of course," the vicar was saying, "as dear old Sidney Smith pointed out, bishops are fond of talking of my see, my clergy, my diocese, as if these things belong to them, as their pigs and dogs belong to them. They forget that the clergy, the diocese, and the bishops themselves all exist only for the public good."
"The tormenting bishop and the tormented curate and so forth," Adam said.
"Exactly. A curate trod on feels a pang as great as when a bishop is refuted. It is quite clear that something must be done."
"Perhaps it already has," Adam said.
The vicar stopped in his tracks.
"Oh dear," he said. "Oh dear, I hadn't thought of that."
"Nor had I, until now," Adam said.
"Hello," he added, as he glanced up and spotted the three of us, Meg, Miss Tanti and me, standing like abandoned brides at the altar.
"What have we here? The three graces, if I'm not mistaken."
"The three graces? Which one was I
wondered. "Charm, beauty, or creativity? And which was Miss Tanti?"
"And Mad Meg."
"Hello, Meg," Adam said. "It's been a long old while, hasn't it?"
Meg sank down in a deep and stately curtsy, her grubby fingers pulling her skirt out into an elaborate black tent and revealing striped stockings and a pair of shockingly battered workman's boots of the Victorian lace-up variety.
"You've met?" I'm afraid I blurted. I couldn't help myself. I could hardly believe that someone like Adam Tradescant Sowerby, M.A., F.R., Hort, S., etc., flora archaeologist and all the rest of it, could possibly know the madwoman who lived in Gibbet Wood.
"Meg and I are old acquaintances, aren't we, Meg?"
Adam said, with a genuine smile, touching his hand to her tattered shawl.
"More than acquaintances, really. Colleagues, I should say. Pals, actually, when it comes right down to it."
Meg's mouth stretched wide in a smile which is best not described.
"Her consultations have kept me, on at least one occasion, from making a pharmacological fool of myself."
"Blood," Meg remarked pleasantly. "The blood of saints and prophets? Blood to drink?"
Her hand waved vaguely toward the shadows.
"And Miss Tanti, if I'm not mistaken," Adam went on. "I've heard nothing but paeans of praise for the way in which you breathe new life into the altar guild."
Miss Tanti pulled a tight smile, which, if anything, was more ghastly than Meg's.
"One does one's best," she said, drawing herself up with rather a fierce glance at the vicar.
I was afraid for a moment that the ferocity of her gaze, focused by the bottle-bottom thickness of her spectacles, would shrivel him up like a bug under a burning glass.
"One can only hope,"
she added, to do one's best in spite of all.
Dear me, the vicar said loudly, consulting his wristwatch. It is getting on, isn't it? Wherever does the time go? Cynthia will be waiting for my contribution to the church leaflet. She's become quite the Cassandra ever since the bishop donated his hand-me-down spirit duplicator to replace our dear old superannuated hectograph.
Cassandra? Was he making an unwitting reference to the ghost of Cassandra Cottlestone, whose sudden uprising from the grave may or may not have been the cause of Cynthia's alleged collapse? The only other Cassandra I could think of was the one used by William Somebody as a pen name for his sometimes scandalous column in the Daily Mirror.
Like the Times, the vicar was saying, Cynthia's sheets are put to bed at midnight.
I could hardly believe my ears. What was the poor dear man thinking about?
The vicar's vegetables, I'm calling my piece, he continued. Something for the congregation to chew on during the week, do you see? I thought that perhaps a bit of levity would go a long way to...
But now, oh dear, whatever will Cynthia think?
What will Cynthia think, indeed, I thought. The last I'd heard of Cynthia Richardson, she'd been given a sedative by Dr. Darby after being scared out of her bloomers in the churchyard by the ghost of Cassandra Cottlestone. Either the injection was just another bit of village gossip, or the vicar was covering up. Cynthia could hardly be stupefied by chloral hydrate and yet still, at the same time, be churning out church bulletins on her Banda machine. It made no chemical sense.
I should have thought you'd be printing something about Mr. Callicutt, Miss Tanty said, with a sly glance at the vicar.
Hold on, I thought. What's going on here? Just minutes ago, the woman had been telling me not to waste my crocuses, and now here she was, practically begging on bended knee for Mr. Callicutt to be given screaming headlines in the church bulletin. Adults can sometimes behave in the most peculiar ways. I'll have to admit that I'd almost forgotten about Mr. Cullicutt myself. As discoverer of his corpse, I felt a certain responsibility toward him, but circumstances in the meantime had kept me from giving him more than a moment's thought. Later, when I was back at Buckshaw, I would turn to a fresh page in my notebook and jot down the pluses and the minuses of the deceased Mr. C. But first, I would need to pump Miss Tanty for details. She, after all, was the one who had made an appointment with the dead man. I was quite certain that, given time, I could extract enough gossip from her to shock even the most hardened tabloid editor in London. If only I could pry her away from Adam and the vicar.
Yes, well, the vicar was saying to Miss Tanty, you really must excuse me.
And with that, he turned and trudged slowly down the aisle toward the door. The image which trickled into my mind was of the ploughman homeward plodding his weary way.
Sowerby? Blood!
Meg was calling excitedly from the east aisle. As the others were still chatting, she had made her way back into the shadows among the pews and was beckoning with an unwashed finger. Adam walked toward her and I followed. After a moment, so did Miss Tanty. The vicar stopped in his tracks and turned. I shall never forget that moment. It is etched into my memory like the image on a treasured Christmas card. The three of us, me, Adam, and Miss Tanty, hovering round the crouching Meg like some weird nativity scene carved in wood. The vicar motionless, keeping watch over his flock by night in the far, shadowy fields of the darkened centre aisle.
Blood!
Meg said again, looking up at us, as if for approval, jabbing at the floor with her filthy finger. On the stones at her feet was a red ooze.
The blood of saints and prophets, she said in a matter-of-fact voice.
In my memory, we are frozen in our places, although there must have been some bending and jostling for a better view of the red puddle at our feet. Meg, complacent now that her work of convincing us is done, squats happily beside the mess,
looking up at our faces in turn.
"For drinking," she explains.
A shaft of sunlight struggles through the colored glass, illuminating the liquid. A fresh drop falls from above, lands with an audible plop, sending out a tiny but perfectly circular wave of ripples on the surface of the red puddle. Meg's bony finger points upward to where the dark timbers of the hammer beam roof stretch like the underside of the floorboards of heaven. Up there, far above our heads, the carved wooden face of Saint Tancred stares down at us as yet another red drop falls from it into our midst. And another.
"Old man's crying," Meg says, simply.
Chapter 10. Oddly enough, the first to react was Miss Tanti, who, with astonishing flexibility for someone her age, climbed down onto her knees and dipped a finger into the shimmering liquid. With this, she crossed herself, first on her forehead and then again on her breast.
"That smeared red stain on her white starched collar is going to be a bugger to get out," I thought.
"Forgive me, O Lord," she said, clasping her hands under her chin and staring up rapturously for some reason at the kaleidoscope of colours that was the head of John the Baptist. Adam produced a white linen handkerchief from his jacket pocket and dipped a corner of it into the ruby-coloured ooze. After examining it closely, he touched it to his tongue.
"Well, why not," I thought, "since everyone else is sampling the stuff."
Reaching round for my pigtail and untying the remaining white ribbon, I dipped it into the edge of the spreading pool, just as another drop fell from the face of the saint in the rafters. Adam caught my eye and gave me a look which said nothing and yet said everything. An invisible wink. I don't think the vicar actually saw any of this. He was still making his way toward us, shuffling awkwardly sideways through the long row of pews which separated us from the center aisle. It seemed to take him forever, but when he reached us at last and was finally standing between Adam and me, he stared without a word at the bloody mess on the floor.
"Now here's a fine pickle," he must have been thinking.
"When the wooden head of a saint begins suddenly weeping blood in a remote village church, who do you call? The police? The Archbishop of Canterbury? Or the news of the world?" "Flavia, dear," he said, laying a quivering hand on my shoulder. "Run outside and fetch Sergeant Graves. There's a good girl." Instantly I felt my face becoming hot, the pressure building up inside my head like Mount Vesuvius. Why were people always doing this to me, ordering me about as if I were some kind of specialized chambermaid kept on hand for emergencies? I counted to 11. No, 12. "Certainly, Vicar," I said, biting my spiritual tongue. Not until I was almost at the door did I add, under my breath, "Would you like a nice cup of tea and a biscuit while I'm at it?" Sergeant Graves was nowhere in sight. The blue Vauxhall was gone, which meant, I supposed, that the police had done what they had come to do and then had vanished. Which explained why the sergeant had allowed me into the church. My cleverly conceived flowers for the altar scheme had been a waste of time. Then, too, Meg had come in and slammed the door explosively without so much as a village constable raising an eyebrow. I should have known it. The police had already been leaving and now they were gone. Which was a shame in a way. If I were completely honest, I would admit that I had been looking forward to renewing old acquaintances with Inspector Hewitt. The inspector and I had what might presently be described as a lukewarm relationship. Mental note. Look up origin of lukewarm. Possibly biblical. One of the finest passages in the Bible, at least to my way of thinking, was from Revelation. "Because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth." A relationship which seemed, somehow, to blow hot and cold depending upon the inspector's glorious wife, Antigone.
I had not yet sorted out the cogs and levers of our somewhat shaky triangular relationship. But it was certainly not for want of trying. I had more than once thrown myself upon this warm, cool goddess, hoping that she would... Would what? Pledge herself to be my true sworn friend and secret sharer? Forever and ever? World without end? Amen? Something like that, I suppose. But it had not quite worked out that way. I had blundered badly by asking her if, on an inspector's salary, they could not afford to have children. Gracious as she had been in her response, I knew that I had hurt her. Although I was not accustomed to apologizing, I had done my best, but her lost babies had haunted my sleep for weeks. What did they look like, I wondered. Had their hair been dark like hers, or fair and wavy like his? Were they boys or girls? Did they smile when she cooed at them and kick up their little feet? What pet names had she whispered to them? And when it came to that, what final names were given to them before they were placed into the earth? Motherhood could be a grim old business, I decided, and one that could never really be shared. In spite of her gentle exterior, there was a part of the inspector's wife that was forever beyond knowing. Perhaps it was like that with all mothers. I was thinking that when a black hillman turned in from the main road and came rushing toward me up the church walk, which was not meant to be used by motor cars. I recognized the driver at once. It was Marmaduke Parr, the bishop's secretary. His car was so well washed that as he climbed out of it, I could see the back of his white mane reflected in its polished paint. "Good morning, Mr. Parr," I said, instinctively anxious to keep him from going into the church. The vicar had troubles enough without having a petty bureaucrat from the diocesan office barging in on what might yet prove to be a miracle. An oaken saint whose eyes wept blood would put an end forever to Saint Tancred's chronic financial problems. The roof fund, after half a century, would be liquidated, and with any luck, those never-ending concerts, fates in the churchyard, and games of tombola in the parish hall would be laid to rest.
"Reverend Parr," he corrected in response to my greeting, "or Father Parr, if you prefer."
The man was biting off more than he could chew. Although he meant it as a snub, he was obviously not aware that for we de Luces, who had been Roman Catholics since the resurrection, there could never be too many bells, books, and candles. Because the vicar was one of Father's few friends, we attended St. Tancred's by choice, rather than force. Father looked favourably upon the many innovations that Denwin Richardson had brought to the parish, and had, in fact, once told the vicar to his face, perhaps joking, that he'd always thought of the Oxford movement as the fold returning to the sheep. All of this, though, was far too complicated to be discussed while standing about in the churchyard. Marmaduke Parr was staring at me petulantly, impatient to be on about his bullying.
"Then good morning to you," he said, and strode off toward the door.
"I wouldn't go in there if I were you," I called out cheerily. "There's been a murder. The place is closed. Off limits. It's the scene of a crime." I used Sergeant Woolmer's exact words, although I didn't bother mentioning that the ban had already been lifted. He stopped in mid-stride and came slowly back toward me. His face and eyes seemed paler than ever.
"What do you mean?" he demanded.
"A murder," I explained patiently, one word at a time. "Someone's been killed in the crypt."
"Who?"
"Mr. Collicat," I whispered importantly. "The organist."
"Collicat? The organist? That's impossible. Why, he was just..."
"Yes," I said, waiting.
"Collicat," he asked again. "Are you sure?"
"Quite sure," I told him. "Everybody in Bishop's Lacey is talking about it."
This was not quite true, but I had come to believe that there's no harm in spreading a little fear where fear is due.
Good Lord, he said. I hope not. I surely hope not.
Now we were getting somewhere.
Is there anything I can do to help? I asked. I was hoping to volunteer to assist with digging out St. Tancred, sorting the bones and so forth, but it looks as if that's off.
I should say it's off, he said.
His face went in an instant from the colour of curds to a blazing shade of beetroot.
It's desecration. Those who are asleep in the Lord are not to be rousted from their graves for the idle entertainment of a pack of vacant villagers.
Vacant villagers, were we? Well, we shall see about that.
I understand you've put a stop to it, I said.
The bishop has put a stop to it, he said,
drawing himself up to his full height, which was fairly substantial. As if he were wearing the bishop's mitre on his head and gripping the bishop's crozier in his closed fist.
And not only the bishop,
he added, as if a clincher were needed.
The Chancellor, too, is dead set against it. He has withdrawn the faculty and forbidden the disinterment. The archaeologists have been sent packing.
Forbidden? I asked. I was interested in the word, and not just because it had an amusing sound.
Strictly forbidden.
He said this with a note of doomsday finality.
And who is the Chancellor?
I asked.
Mr. Ridley Smith, the magistrate.
Mr. Ridley Smith, the magistrate? I thought. Cassandra Cottlestone's father had been a magistrate, Daffy had told me, and as such was able to move heaven and earth to the extent even of having his suicide daughter buried in consecrated ground.
That would be the Ridley Smiths of Bogmore Hall, I said.
Everyone knew about the Ridley Smiths of Bogmore Hall at Nether Wolsey. They were the subject of stories that had once been whispered behind elaborate paper fans, but were now likely chatted about over cigarettes in the ABC tea shop. I had heard, for instance, from Feely's friend Sheila Foster about Lionel Ridley Smith, who thought he was made of glass, and his sister, Anthea, whose pet crocodile had eaten a chambermaid.
That, of course, was before the First War, Sheila had said, when chambermaids were thicker on the ground than they are nowadays.
And didn't Miss Pickery, the librarian, have a married sister, Hetty, who lived in Nether Wolsey? Hetty had suffered what Miss Mountjoy, the former librarian, had once referred to as a tragic accident with a sewing machine. And what was it Miss Cool at the confectionery had contributed to my storehouse of knowledge about the mysterious but absent Hetty?
The singer, the needle, the finger, the twins, the wayward husband, the bottle, the bills, she had told me.
That, of course, had been almost a year ago, but with any luck, Hetty would be more than ever on the lookout for someone who was willing to babysit twins.
Yes, that's right, Marmaduke Parr said with a sniff. The Ridley Smiths of Bogmore Hall.
And before you could say anti-transubstantiationalist, Gladys and I were speeding along the narrow tarmac on our way to Nether Wolsey. By hook or by crook, by fair means or foul, I would make Chancellor Ridley Smith eat his words. Strictly forbidden indeed. To the south and west of Buckshaw was a crossroads, its left arm being, by way of Nether Lacey, more or less a back road to Doddingsley. To the right was St. Elfrida's, and beyond it, a little farther to the south, lay Nether Wolsey. I saw at once, as I approached, that it was not the prettiest village in England. Not by a long chalk.
Even the trees looked tired.
The most notable landmark was an ancient butcher's shop huddled among terraced houses, its grey, unpainted boards sagging like a wooden drape, giving the place the pallor of the undead. In the fly-blown window hung an odd arrangement of sausages, tied into strings and loops, and it took me more than a few moments to realize that they spelled out, rather distastefully, the word meats. A bell tinkled as I opened the door, and then, except for the buzzing of a solitary fly in the window, the shop fell back into silence.
Hello,
I called. The fly buzzed on.
A glass case stretched halfway across the back of the narrow room, and in it were stretched out various slabs of raw meat in a grisly display of red, white, and blue that made my stomach wince. Behind the counter, mounted in an ornate wrought iron stand, was a roll of pinkish butcher paper. A length of heavy string dangled handily down from a small wire cage fastened to the ceiling. At the rear of the shop, in a corner, stood a bloodied butcher block, and behind it was an open door which obviously led to the area behind the shop.
Hello, I called again. There was no answer. I edged round the glass case and stuck my head out the door. The garden was littered with empty wooden crates. A reddened tree stump was obviously being used as a chopping block, whose victims came from the chicken coops beyond. As I stood there, not quite knowing what to do next, a tiny woman in a skirt, blouse, and bandana emerged from the largest chicken coop, gripping a large brown hen by its feet. The bird hung struggling upside down, its stubby wings flapping helplessly. As she placed its neck on the block and reached for the hatchet, she spotted me in the shop's open doorway.
Go back inside, she said. I shall be there directly.
Her bare spindly arm raised the polished blade.
No, wait, I heard myself saying. Please.
The woman looked up, the axe poised.
Please, I said. I want to buy that bird, but I want it alive.
What on earth had come over me? Although I didn't mind dead humans, in fact, in some ways I delighted in them. I knew in that instant I could not bear the thought of harm coming to any other creature. It hadn't been all that long since I had been attacked in Bishop's Lacey by a maddened rooster. And yet, in spite of that bloody free-for-all, my protective wings seemed at this very moment to be sheltering every chicken in the universe. It was a most peculiar feeling.
Alive,
I managed, my head spinning like a toy top. The woman put down the hatchet and flung the bird away from her. It flew, actually flew, across the yard, made a half-decent landing, and began pecking at the hardened earth as if nothing had happened. I knew that if Daffy were here, she would have said,
Curfew shall not ring tonight.
This particular hen, at least for now, would live to cluck another day. I had saved my first life.
Is there life after death for chickens? I wondered.
Given the prospect of the axe, the plucking, the seething pot, the heat of the oven, and the gnawings of our hungry teeth at the Sunday table, it seemed somehow unlikely.
And yet,
in spite of all that, perhaps there really was the reward of a heavenly roost somewhere above the bright blue sky.
I came away without my money, I said. I'll bring it to you as soon as I can.
Not from around here, are you? The woman asked, walking toward me.
No, but not far, I said, waving a vague hand toward the north.
Haven't I seen you before?
She asked, close enough now to peer into my face. It was at that moment that I was struck with a brilliant thought. Tell the truth.
Yes, that was it. Tell the truth. What did I have to lose?
Perhaps you have, I told her. My name is Flavia Deluce.
Of course, she said. I should have known. The blue eyes, the...
She stopped as if she had run into a stone wall.
Yes?
We used to take poultry to Buckshaw, she said slowly. To Mrs. Mullet. I suppose she's long gone.
No, I said. She's still with us.
Fortunately, I was quick enough to add.
But that was years ago, the woman said. Years ago, before... But tell me, what brings you to Nether Wolsey?
I'm looking for a woman named Hetty. I don't know her last name, but she's...
Patsy Pickery's sister.
Patsy? Was Patsy Miss Pickery's name?
I put my hand in front of my mouth to suppress a smile.
Yes, I said, that's the one, Patsy Pickery's sister.
I enjoyed pronouncing the name, the way it rolled off my tongue in a limping rhyme.
Patsy Pickery's sister.
Gone, she said. She's took the kids and gone. Lived right across the road next to the petrol station till Rory belted her once too often, and she took the kids and... What do you want with her anyway?
I wanted to ask her a question.
Maybe I can answer it.
It's about Bogmore Hall, I said, and I could see the woman's face closing even before the words were out of my mouth.
Keep clear of Bogmore Hall, she warned. It's not the kind of place for someone like you.
Someone like me? Whatever could she mean by that?
There's something I need to discuss with Mr. Ridley Smith, the magistrate. Got yourself into some kind of trouble, have you?
She asked, closing one eye like Popeye.
No, not really. Well, all the same, don't go hanging round. Things aren't right up there, if you take my meaning.
Her finger came, almost automatically, it seemed, to her head.
The Ridley Smiths, you mean? The crocodile? The man who was made of glass?
The woman snorted.
Made of glass, my Fanny, she said. You listen to me. There are things that are worse than glass and crocodiles. You keep away from that place.
She waved her hand toward what I guessed was the southwest.